Hello, everyone. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Incremental Sampling Methodology Update, ISM2. We're doing an expert panel today, so we are here to respond to your questions. My name is Evan Madden. I am your moderator today, coming to you live from Arlington, Virginia. If you have not already done so, we encourage you to visit the guidance document at ism2-itrcweb.org. We will put this in the chat here in a moment. Use the Q&A pod during the session to ask questions or report any technical problems that you may be experiencing. But first, we're going to do a brief overview on the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating in today. We encourage you to visit itrcweb.org to learn more about our organization. Additionally, the full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any of our materials, we do ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. That said, here on slide 4, I'm welcoming our expert trainers that have joined us today. Not only are these trainers volunteers, but they've dedicated many hours to developing sessions 1 and 2 of incremental sampling methodology, which are archived and available for on-demand viewing and listening on Cluent. We're coming together to answer any questions with this expert panel today. So with that said, I'm gonna go ahead and jump right into question 1 to get us started here. So that said, let's define some of the terms we're gonna go here and recap in ISM. I'd like to turn the floor over to Jason. Would you be interested and able to give us a quick overview of some of the concepts covered in module 0 of session 1?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Broderson, and I was one of the key authors for the document. And just kind of a 2-minute overview of the intro module and just some of the key concepts that we'll be talking about. The definition of incremental sampling is a statistically supported technique for assessing the mean concentration of any volume of sediment or soil. It is conducted through the collection of a highly structured composite sample. It's both a sampling and a processing protocol. The sample itself is anywhere between 30 and 100 increments. An increment is often a core or a small volume of soil that we composited together to provide the incremental sample. Depending on your level of confidence required and the contaminants and the size of interest, that's what can dictate the number of increments that you're using. So the area of soil that we're talking about is defined as a decision unit. Some practitioners use the term sampling unit when multiple incremental samples are used to make a decision. Those terms can be used interchangeably. Like I said, the increment is the small volume of soil that is composited together to make up your incremental sample. And an important piece, really a key piece of incremental sampling, is the use of replicates. We use the term replicates a little bit interchangeably with triplicates, but you can have more than 3 replicates, therefore it can be just used as replicates. I've worked on projects where we've done up to 7 replicates for a specific decision unit. I want to emphasize the importance of planning. It is a sampling technique where you get one data point for each incremental sample. And so it's super important for everyone to know how you're going to use that data point and its replicates. It kind of falls back on the importance of a conceptual site model. What is the question that you're trying to answer? Who are the different users of this data? How are you going to use the data? What are the follow-up steps, right? How are you going to use this data? Are you going to try to do it in one sampling event? Are you going to go back to decision units if you need to? So asking all those questions are a key part of the conceptual site model. And then finally, really what I think is more the art than science of all of incremental sampling is just, how are you setting up your decision unit? It's the most important part of incremental sampling because it is really the beginning and dictates how things happen from there. It's not a one-time thing. You can always go back to decision units and subdivide them if you want or sample them again. But really just always ask yourself, how are you setting up your decision unit and how are you going to use that data? So that's my overview.
Thanks for the overview, Jason. I really appreciate it. Just wanted to, again, for those of you that are coming in late on the line, we do have a Q&A pod in the bottom menu of your Zoom window. You can click on that and input any questions you may have into that pod, and we will be able to have our experts answer those live on the call. So just wanted to make sure, again, that you're aware of that. But that said, I think we'll move over into our second question. So the ISM2 training series was presented in March of 2021 first. What has changed in the last year? I know we have Todd Miller online. Todd, would you care to take a crack at that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Evan. So in almost the 2 years since the document has come out, the concepts, methodologies, and practices really haven't changed in that time. ISM is becoming better understood by both consultants and regulators. We've heard from some regulators that ISM is being used for even more interesting and complex sites. However, there's still some misconceptions that we often hear being used with ISM. For example, will ISM miss areas of elevated concentration, or that it will in fact dilute the concentrations that you get. And I'll just remind folks here that if you go back to section 3.1 of the document, you'll see that ISM is designed to provide a statistical representation of the expected concentration of the constituents of concern within any given decision unit. So, it's designed to give you that expected concentration, or as Jason had said, the mean concentration for a decision unit. The key to obtaining results that are representative is in the planning, as Jason had said, and I hope everybody on the line really hears this and starts thinking about it. Really is the planning and deciding what a decision unit is and why. As we summarize in section 9 of the document, the team should involve your regulators, key stakeholders, and parties that are really going to be involved with planning or use of the data that you're going to collect. And getting that planning done early is a key component to a successful project. There does seem to still need to be some means of outreach or education for this process, hence this training is continuing. But also we urge others to talk to their regulators about the process and really get a better understanding of how the different states are viewing it and using this process on particular sites. And as we discussed during last year's training, and as Jason had said, and a very strong point, which is planning really is the key to a successful outcome. Planning needs to include, all aspects of the project, from how you're going to collect the data, who's going to collect it, to how is it going to be used. And section 9 really gives a good description of, why these components are important and how to engage stakeholders and how to keep those stakeholders on track with what the objectives of the program are. Mark, I'll ask you, from a laboratory perspective, what you're seeing with respect to changes in the ISM world.
Okay. I mean, originally ISM was developed for use on military training ranges and then expanded to other parts of military sites. And then from there kind of grew out to other applications of surface soil characterization, and then kind of expanded from there into subsurface soil. We've even seen applications on brownfield sites. And basically, the general rule of thumb, if you're trying to manage significant heterogeneity, then ISM is a tool that you should at least consider, if not actually conclude that it's actually the best tool for helping to manage that heterogeneity. The range of chemicals of concern have greatly expanded from the original energetics and metals and to a wider range of semi-volatile organics and volatile organics. And then we've got the probably the most ubiquitously requested group of analytes in terms of our polyfluorinated alkyl substances. We're seeing a lot more PFAS sites that are now being requested, and that has its own special constraints in terms of managing contamination, both during the sample collection as well as during the sample processing and analysis. So by and large, it's just growing all over the place. So Chris or Karen, do you have any thoughts as to, from a state regulator perspective, on the types of sites or analyte groups that ISM is being applied for?
Sure, yeah. In Michigan, we're seeing a lot of new users, just like you guys have said. A couple of new labs that are into the marketplace now using incremental sampling. The processing, again, it's both the field work and the processing in the lab. So you've got to be on the same page with that. So we've been tracking that. As you said, PFAS is a hot topic in Michigan. We really are seeing a lot of that, both biosolids, residential areas, a lot of brownfields. We have a few rail trail projects that we're using incremental sampling on which involve urban fill, kind of understanding that. And then some pretty big projects where we're trying to understand the current conditions with incremental sampling, and then how they manage that and do all the cuts and fills, and then really coming back as a separate phase to do the final grade, right? Which is then going to be, what is the exposure for the next 30 years or 50 years, right? So we're really kind of doing that in two phases. The initial phase to do some investigation and soil management, but then we really can't use that data to do the final decision-making. We have to do that as a separate, whole separate phase. So again, I think the snowball is rolling down the hill, that we're really seeing a lot of really good work. We're working with consultants who are new to the game early and making sure that they're successful. And we're really seeing some great outcomes. You know, consultants, all of us like to see reproducible samples. So when our relative standard deviations come back real tight, our data come back tight, it makes everybody look good. So that's the experience in Michigan. We're glad people are using it and encouraging more and more to use it. Karen?
Hey, thanks, Chris. Well, here in California, a lot of the sites that I work on are former ag fields. I'm a toxicologist and risk assessor, so I serve as a expert to our project managers and don't see the breadth of sites as some people do, but I do know that we have them, have used it at federal facilities and other former industrial locations also. So we are seeing a wide range of use in ISM, and it is increasing. And we are preparing a guidance document here at DTSC for the use of ISM, citing this ITRC guidance document for sampling from former ag field areas. Now I'll turn it back over to Evan, unless there are other questions or comments.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate it. We did get a comment or a question asking about ISM and more specifically its relation to PFAS on a state level. So I was wondering if anyone online would like to comment about that.
Yeah, I could take a stab. It all comes down to criteria, right? What is the criteria you're going to be comparing against? In many of the PFAS, whether it's a groundwater surface water interface number or a soil protective of groundwater drinking water number, that's really where that's at. A lot of the PFAS that we've done in Michigan is more, is it present? and kind of understanding its presence or absence at this point. So again, I think you really have to then talk with the lab, as Mark mentioned, lots of PFAS happening, but then also kind of understand the toxicology and what are the criteria that you're applying it to. You really need to have that all figured out in the planning stages, so that we're all on the same page. That's our perspective in Michigan.
Mark, could you expand on this maybe a bit more, or Tamara?
I was just going to note that, we are seeing increasing requirements to analyze for PFAS in soil, and a number of states now have developed soil criteria for PFAS. So I think it's going to be a growing need. And again, you can use this ISM the way you would for any other analyte, but as noted, it depends on your criteria. And of course, there's a lot of additivity debates going on.
Mark, Jason, would either of you like to add to that?
We're seeing more requests for PFAS analysis from ISM collected samples. Again, in this case, primarily surface soils. And, as I mentioned earlier, only a couple of our PFAS labs are actually set up to handle, or only a couple of our ISM labs are set up to handle the cleanliness requirements of PFAS, since you're typically looking at much lower levels. And so it's something that can be done, but just as with lots of other things PFAS related, it's more difficult than your average organic analyte.
And can one of you speak to whether, PFAS and ISM is being used for PFAS, but it was asked whether PFAS was more of a groundwater issue than a soil issue per se.
It's more of a regulatory question, so I'll let one of our state folks jump in on that one.
Well, I'm not a state regulator, but I thought I responded to that just by noting that there are a number of published criteria now that states have released for PFAS in soil, and we are increasingly being asked to analyze for PFAS in soil. Mm-hmm. So I think it's moving from beyond just a groundwater concern.
Right. And understanding that soil concentration, certainly incremental sampling is the way to get what is the source, what is the volume of soil. Getting a good number for a representative volume of soil is what incremental sampling is all about. So this is the method to use. Now, what criteria you apply, how that all fits into the source that then gets to the groundwater and could be someone's drinking water. That's really more of a state-specific question that you're going to need to work through. What is that criteria that you're going to be applying it? And that should all be done before the sampling takes place. Otherwise, then you're really just doing an absence or presence discussion.
Thanks, Chris. We did have a question involving pro-UCL and UCL calculations. Haley Brittingham, I think we have Haley on the line. Would you care to speak to that? Oh, you're muted. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a great question. So with pro-UCL version 5.2, it's no longer going to recommend the Chebyshev UCL. And it's true that the Chebyshev UCL does tend to overestimate the mean compared to some other choices. However, with the ISM2 document, we're talking about specific recommendations related to ISM designs. And so typically we're not gonna have as many samples as if you took discrete samples, and that limits us with respect to what UCLs we can use. So in pro-UCL, if you were to input an ISM data set with between 3 and 6 samples, it's going to estimate all of these different UCLs for you that might not be appropriate just because you don't have enough samples to, for example, determine that you have a gamma distribution or to use any bootstrap methods. So really long story short, with between 3 and 6 samples that are going to be most typical with ISM designs, really your only choices are the TUCL and the Chebyshev UCL. And so if you determine that your data are too skewed to use the TUCL, then the Chebyshev UCL is really going to be your only option. Another alternative is that if you find that the Chebyshev UCL looks to be much higher than your sample mean, and say, for example, your UCL is higher than your screening level, but maybe your sample mean is less than your screening level, then that's an example where you might want to collect additional data. And so if you have additional samples, that opens the door for you to be able to use a different method of UCL calculation.
Thanks, Haley. We have another question, a little more general, so this is open up to everybody. What has changed in the use of statistics, particularly in relation to background?
Yeah, I can take that one as well. I'm not sure there's much that's changed since the ISM2 document came out. We still recommend doing background comparisons through valid statistical tests, like, for example, a t-test is one example of that. We don't recommend calculating BTBs with ISM designs, and that's typically, again, because of the small sample size. So you really need a pretty large sample size to calculate a BTB, and that's not typically going to be appropriate with ISM designs. And then in addition to that, since ISM samples represent the mean, it kind of complicates the conceptualization or, you know, how you interpret a calculated BTB. It doesn't really make sense to collect samples that represent the mean and then try to calculate an upper percentile from those samples. So that kind of gets a little bit complicated. So for that reason, we recommend doing valid statistical tests, like, for example, a 2-sample t-test or similar tests.
Thanks, Haley. Just up next, we have another question, I believe, for Mr. Bruce. With traditional contaminants, the ISM laboratory processing requires the nugget effect associated with small diameter tar, paint chips, et cetera. Have you observed nugget effects with PFAS? Is PFAS binding preferentially with specific types of soil particles?
Well, I can't say that we have specifically observed that nugget effect. I mean, it's obviously most pronounced for explosives and metal fragments, and there's been a little bit of evidence suggesting that it could apply to PCBs as they get released as oils that then form these little tar balls. Well, PFAS, as it's, you know, covers thousands of compounds at this point, there isn't a universal answer for that. It is certainly reasonable to think there might be some of those individual PFAS components that might have a tendency to form nuggets, but by and large, we're not seeing obvious evidence of that yet, but it's still relatively early in the application process.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. So let's take another question. Derek's got a question. Considering PFAS can be transported through the natural evapotranspiration process and deposited elsewhere, where there's not an immediate identifiable source of PFAS contamination, how does that affect liability in regard to responsibility for soil decontamination efforts?
I would say that means it's ubiquitous across the globe, unfortunately. That's a huge question, to be honest. That makes it difficult. You would certainly need to understand what is a source and why are you sampling where you're sampling? What does the mere presence and any sort of idea of a background concentration, a naturally occurring or a industrial occurring background concentration mean. But those are the discussions that you need to be in pretty detailed discussion with your state regulator and understand what those if-then statements are going to look like. So doing a data quality objective process, filling out the if-then statements. If we have single digit parts per trillion, what does that mean? Does that mean we have to go out and sample? Does that mean that we are a responsible party? Those discussions should be occurring throughout the DQO process prior to sampling.
I'll just add in, thank you, Chris, that background issue. And if we have documented background concentrations that we have designed our studies adequately for, then we would consider that in the risk assessment also. And it would be evaluated and it may or may not be, you know, depending on what the concentrations were, compared to background levels, an issue ultimately in the risk assessment. So really it would be important to consider backgrounding, as Chris mentioned, involve your team so that we can make sure everyone is being able to use the data for the questions they need to see answered within the investigation.
Thanks, Karen. And thanks all for chiming in on that one. Jeff asks, are soil disposal facilities accepting ISM results for waste characterization? I've run into one facility who had not heard of ISM and refused to accept the results for characterization.
I mean, I can try to answer that. That's a great question. It's great because RCRA has some specific regs and language in there that is sometimes interpreted differently by different users. I've got a lot of clients that ask that same question. It's kind of interesting because, you know, you as the generator are responsible for your waste profile, right? And the accepting facility can accept it or not. They can choose not to accept it. I feel like as a generator, you want to make sure you've got the most valid and supported data in terms of your profile. We've sent tons of samples off to landfills in California that have accepted ISM, but I'll state that we don't necessarily tell them exactly how we're doing it. We just fill out the profile. We give them the concentrations and they accept it. We've had discussions with our state agencies in California about how ISM does fit into RCRA and the California hazardous waste laws. And it's a convoluted discussion that goes a variety of ways depending on who's interpreting the regs differently. So I'm not necessarily giving any clarity to your question other than as the generator, you're responsible for the profile. And my advice would be if they have questions about it, tell them that you're convinced that that's the most appropriate profile for your waste stream.
And Jason, I'll add on to that. In certain states, they do have requirements for discrete samples. And it depends on the state you're working in, as well as potentially, you know, if your site has a sampling and analysis plan or a DQO plan, a lot of times your waste characterization is spelled out in that plan. So it could very well be state specific requirements or site specific requirements. But I agree that sitting down with the landfill and explaining to them it's a composite sample, because a lot of landfills do accept composite samples as a waste stream representative sample. So it does require a little more discussion up front. And again, these are some of the discussions that you want to have and some of the conversations you want to have and bring into certain stakeholders at the planning phase of the project. So I would suggest that people have that that conversation up front, during the planning stage.
I was going to agree with Jason and Todd. You know, you got to talk about it up front, but really the purpose of waste characterization is to collect a sample that's representative of your waste stream as a whole. And I think there's solid scientific arguments to be had that ISM is the best way to do that for a lot of waste streams.
Thanks, Thomas. Following up, what are the most common ISM sample processing options, and when should they be selected? Maybe Mark, if you'd like to kick this one off.
Okay. Yeah. Could you go ahead and show slide 26 as I answer this one? Okay. What we have seen from, there you go. What we have seen when we originally developed ISM-1, there was a lot of uncertainty as to what was going to be selected in terms of the most common options. And at this point, things have kind of coalesced down into just a few very commonly selected options. For most sample types and analyte groups, we typically start with air drying and then disaggregate, breaking up the dirt clods. And then in most cases, do some sort of sieving. Using a number 10 sieve is the most common. And then either proceed from there directly into subsampling to produce the analytical subsample that goes into the sample prep and analysis process. Or sometimes there will be an intermediate milling step if it's important to do further particle size reduction. So those are kind of the two most common options. Another that shows up is if there are significant concerns that some of the analytes might be lost or degraded during the air drying step, we will actually use the two-dimensional slab cake process and actually collect the analytical subsample on the as-received sample. That shows up in some of the Hawaii guidance documents and a number of other instances where we're working with low-boiling, semi-volatile organic compounds that are not strongly retained onto the soil particles. So those are kind of the three most common options. Obviously, there are a number of permutations in those in terms of using different sieve sizes for different data end uses. There are some options in terms of what you want to use for milling. But by and large, it's kind of coalesced down to those three primary options at this point in time.
Thank you, Mark. Kind of going off that same vein of thought, Michael asks, the state of Washington requires discrete sediment samples so that the results can be equated to discrete biota samples, which I find to not be discrete anyway. Is there a thought to work on this issue?
Well, Evan, Todd Miller here. In reading the question, I would ask, if we're talking about sediment samples from a wetlands where they're being hand collected, or side of a stream bank, or if you're actually out in the water on a barge or on a small ship, because there certainly is from a sampling complexity nature. If you're talking about collecting samples from a river, there certainly is a complex nature in how those samples get collected. If we're talking about following the SCUM2 guidance document from the state of Washington, then the samples that they do describe are not necessarily discrete, because they do talk about grab samples and multiple grabs from a single area for certain sampling. So I think it becomes a little complicated and probably a little more complicated than what we can address here with a simple question. But if others have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in, because I think Michael's question is relevant to a lot of different programs out there. There are still a lot of state and some federal programs that require discrete samples. That's a challenging one. And we've been dealing with that in California with a couple of lead agencies over the years, really since 2008. And it's very difficult to get an agency, if they've got something in writing in a guidance, or especially if it's in regulation, to come around to how to handle ISM. And so there's not a good answer for that, other than continue to work with their agency, see if they can, take these trainings, see if they can go to some of the longer trainings, see if you can start to introduce some of the concepts of incremental sampling in terms of replicates and how to understand and quantify your heterogeneity of your contaminant or your media, and try to get them to think along the paths of, okay, well, what can we do to help control heterogeneity, and more importantly, what can we do to increase the confidence in any data points we get back? So I think that's just the struggle that a lot of the folks who've been working in the industry for a long time have been up against. I mean, I've been working on this for 18 years, and you know, some agencies jump right into it, but some want to do it, but their hands are tied based on the guidances. And it's just about trying to get them to think about increased confidence in data.
Yeah. And as a state regulator for 30 years, that's actually what we're doing. So we're actually training our own staff. So next week I have 20 staff that are going through an intense week-long class on incremental sampling and the concepts and really kind of breaking down some of those barriers of, as you said, this is a continuing crusade that we're on to really insert common sense, good scientific data. And again, the science is there, the reproducibility is there. These are defendable samples because very few discrete sample planning projects actually have that replicate data to determine how reproducible is this data. So again, continue to have those discussions, but certainly there are parts of state laws that are difficult to overcome. There are different state guidance documents that are difficult to overcome, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try from both the inside as a regulator and from the outside consultant and work together. That's the beauty of ITRC is we were able to do that and build this guidance document to help all of us do a better job.
And I can't remember off the top of my head who it was, but I thought we had a member from the state of Washington as part of the ISM team. So you might try to find out who that is and put them in contact with the regulators that you're interfacing with. I know I'm working on a project right now that US EPA actually came to us and suggested we use ISM for characterizing stream samples. We were trying to do confirmation samples after a record cleanup. You take a grab sample here and you get one result, a grab sample there, and another widely different result. So we ended up, doing an ISM sampling program, which we thought would be simple at first. But like we talked about early on, you got to get all the stakeholders involved early on. So we had a whole site CSM for the project. When we wanted to do a stream ISM sample, we had to create a refined CSM that just addressed the stream, all the potential sources of the stream, on-site runoff of sediment, off-site runoff of sediment, some within the regulatory agency had some concerns about potential groundwater contributing to contamination of the sediment. So we ended up with a greatly diverse group of people involved in setting up that ISM program. We haven't reached the end yet. It's still in progress. But I can tell you that there are precedent for regulatory agencies preferring ISM to characterizing sediments. And I mean, one of the simplest answers are is the critters in the stream don't stay in the same place all the time. You may have a grab sample and want to be linked to a specific biota sample, but things don't work that well in the real world. Things move around in the stream. The sediments move, the critters move. So really, I don't see it being scientifically defensible to, say one grab sample equals one biota sample.
And we've done that at stream sediment sampling in Michigan. And again, there's a whole group, as you said, Tom, at EPA, Matt Jefferson, Nate Barlett, Josh Barber just gave a really great presentation on sediment sampling related to Philadelphia area in EPA region there. So there's a lot of really great work that's happening, a lot of great EPA people who are also on this mission to spread the good news of incremental sampling. So there's a lot of great connections out there. I think if there's a Washington state person that you can connect with, don't give up. Keep presenting this to the regulator.
Speaking the gospel of sampling, we're going to keep kind of on that same subject. I'm wondering, do you have recommendations on how to plan samples so not to miss small areas of elevated concentrations? Again, still kind of playing off that same thought. Todd, would you care to speak to that?
Yeah, so thanks, Evan. Good question. It really comes back down to probably the central theme you're hearing today, which is planning and your site conceptual model. Section 3.1 of the document has some good examples of why this really shouldn't be a concern. You know, if your team has a good understanding of the conceptual site model, then you can set up your sampling units and your decision units to be more representative of the site, and not just the site, but the questions you're trying to answer. And again, you know, it's all about the planning and understanding how you're going to use the data and how your stakeholders want to use the data and what data are important to collect. There are certainly tools out there like Visual Sampling Plan, which we haven't talked about, VSP, that can help design your sampling program. Section 3.4 has some cost benefit discussions in it that you can look at to evaluate how you collect data from small areas versus large areas and where those cost values or those cost benefits might be. One of the other things to look at is simply your number of increments and your number of replicates. How many increments are you collecting for each area and how many replicates are you collecting? So you can make sure that you have a statistically representative set of data. I don't know if others have Tom or Jason have things to add.
I mean, I guess one of the things, I'll just add two things briefly. One is that incremental sampling has been used for years in the identification of trace elements in geologic units. I mean, it's designed to find things. It's not designed to hide things. So just think about how that's how the mining industry finds trace elements. Another thing to think about is, well, what's the alternative? It's pretty hard to develop a sampling grid with discrete samples that are going to find the kind of hotspot or elevated concentration that you're concerned ISM is going to miss. So you can have very small decision units. You can have decision units that are 2 feet by 2 feet. We've done it before. You can have large decision units that can then you can go back and subdivide them into 4, 6, 8, 16 smaller decision units. And that's really how you're going to drill down and find those elevated concentrations within an area.
Yeah, like you said, Jason, you think about it the same way you would collecting grab samples. You know, you kind of know where you suspect your source to be, and you size your decision units and locate them in such a way to collect the information you're trying to collect. And I thought you hit on a great point that, you know, was one of my parts of the document. You know, this originated in the mining industry where people wanted to find gold and other precious metals. So it certainly is designed to help find hotspots, not to avoid hotspots.
That's a great analogy, Tom. When planning for ISM, what do you need to do to appropriately plan for the intended use of data? Or who do you need to include in the planning process? Todd, maybe you want to tackle this one first off.
Yeah, so as you've all have heard here today, you know, the planning process is a critically important part of what we're what the program is all about. And it takes the whole group, from your stakeholders of folks that are going to use the data, whether that be your regulators or other third parties that might be involved in using or understanding the data, your project team, you know, how are you going to collect the data? Who's going to collect it? What are the skill sets that are needed? You know, is this going to be in water or on land collection? So getting your project team involved, getting the laboratory involved early in the process is critical. A lot of people don't really think about that. They consider, I'm going to collect some samples. I'll just send it off to, you know, Mark at the lab and have him analyze it. And there are certain key aspects that need to be understood by the laboratory, and the laboratory can really help you plan, how much sample is needed, where it gets shipped, and as well as in what condition, what type of containers, and also letting them know in advance, because it's not a easy process to analyze or process an ISM sample. Also getting your risk assessors and your statisticians involved early in the process. Another group of folks that we sometimes go to at the last minute saying, hey, I really need this data, you know, analyzed or validated. Getting them involved early and helping getting their use and their specialties to help you plan the process is critical in making sure that you're collecting the right number of increments, that the data you're going to get can be supported through statistics, and that the risk assessors give a real hard look at what questions are trying to be answered and will that data that you're going to collect answer those.
Yeah, we do tend to forget about our risk assessors till the very last minute. And on my sediment project, I was describing, as a geologist, I never would have thought about it. But my eco-risk assessor knew what the test organisms were going to be for the eco-risk assessment and pointed out to me that one of them lives at the water-sediment interface. The other is a burrowing critter. So I had to set up my incremental sampling methodology, not only plan-wise, but depth-wise, to be able to address both of those questions of what was going to happen to either one of those test organisms. I'd have never thought about it without risk assessor input.
Yeah, and as a risk assessor, thanks, Tom, for pointing out the exposure area for different receptors. And that is something that we want to help you design within your ISM studies to make sure that the exposure area is appropriate for the sampling, the decision unit.
Thanks, Karen. We have another question regarding sampling. To increase confidence in discrete sample data, would it not be common sense to have a discrete sample processed at the lab following ITRC ISM process designed to provide mean value for the sample in the jar? An 8-ounce soil jar can have significant grouping and segregation errors. A random test aliquo from an 8-ounce jar is no more representative than a random test aliquo of unprocessed ISM sample.
Yep, I'll speak to that one. We, on a few occasions, have had clients request ISM processing on discrete samples. And yes, it does improve representativeness of that analytical subsample when done appropriately. But it's rarely requested, but certainly could be done. Usually our clients that are most interested in representativeness and reproducibility also go to the additional effort of actually collecting the sample using an ISM process in the field. In short, just digging out any old random spot, you end up with significant heterogeneity and high variability results. Trying to stir the sample in the jar helps a little bit, but going to full ISM processing significantly improves reproducibility.
Right, and you can mix that 8-ounce jar all you want, but if you picked a bad spot to grab the sample, it doesn't matter. Representativeness, if your sampling crew doesn't mix that grab sample appropriately in the field, if it gets shooken up on the way to the lab and it segregates, and Mark, I hate to say it, but sometimes, an analyst will just grab a scoop off of the top of a jar instead of, trying to make sure they get a representative scoop, and you're only analyzing a small bit. All that stuff can really screw up your results, and you're basing a lot of money on those results. So it's worth the effort of ISM.
Yep.
Interesting point. Thanks for talking to that one. We have another question in the chat. One thing I run to is that if your ISM sample comes back exceeding a limit, then you have to clean up the whole DU. Is it legitimate to go back and subdivide a DU? And if you set up a DU and didn't like the data, can you even start over?
And I'll start with that one. And definitely it is legitimate to divide up the DU and resample. I had a case where we did have in this case, it was PAHs, and it was a larger decision unit, which came back above our screening levels. So we did go back and subdivide it into four separate smaller sampling units, and we were able to have tighter data, and all of the data then were below the screening level and no cleanup was needed. Another alternative is that you narrow you refine your spatial characterization of the elevated area. So that is a really good way to further define where the concentrations are for a chemical that might be above your cleanup criteria.
Thanks, Karen. Anybody else?
Well, I guess I want to clarify a little bit here is that, you know, if you don't like your data, I mean, the data is the data. I think that ISM, you're going to have a lot more confidence in your ISM sample the more increments you collect and the more replicates you collect and the smaller area that you collect them from. So I think if you think about in theory, the way ISM works, if you had one large decision unit, and I'm just going to use broad numbers here, with 100 increments, and you went back to and split it into four, and each of those only did 25 increments, you should get the same result. The average from those four should equal the average for the above. But if you go back and you split those four into 100 increments each, now you've in essence turned your initial decision unit that was with 100 increments into four increments that total 400 increments. So you get a lot more confidence in that data. Likely you will find where the contamination is. In terms of if your confidence is lower and so you're over an action level with your first sample, it might be because your confidence interval is much higher because you had too few increments. So you should trust the data as it comes in and then refine it as you need to.
Yeah, and Jason, thank you for mentioning that. And I will just reiterate, all too often people think of decision unit as I'm going to go out and sample, I'm going to get an answer, and that's going to tell me if I need to clean up or not. Well, I would like to put out there that, is that really the question you're asking? A lot of these decision units are helping us define where we have impacts. And your decision might be, okay, I've selected a decision unit, I get an answer. What I'm really trying to determine is, do I need more data? So yes, it's absolutely appropriate to go back and take a decision unit that has a single unit value result and then further divide that into certain areas and identify new smaller decision units. So yes, that's appropriate. But I also agree with Jason, we just shouldn't throw out old data. You know, that data is representative and it should be considered as we move down the road. But
thanks, Todd. And just if we could squeeze in one last question. I was wondering, Tamara, if you have a second, do we have to collect, or the question is, do I have to collect ISM background?
I would highly recommend it, yes, because you can't compare an ISM UCL to discrete background data. There's no way to do that. I mean, you could do something semi-quantitative. If you go out and you do your ISM program and you're, you know, way below the published background range on sort of a qualitative level, you might be in luck, but you can't really compare them. It's apples and oranges. So I really do recommend that you establish one or more background decision units. And also, if you look in the guidance, you will see that those decision units don't necessarily have to consist of one continuous area. You can create a decision unit from sort of a cobbled together background range. And sometimes that's more practical where you don't have large background areas to choose from.
Thank you so much, Tamara. That being said, I think we're going to start wrapping things up. I just wanted to say again, thank you so much for all of our trainers, for all of your time and efforts putting together this guidance and this training and for your participation today. All of you left on the line, thank you so much for your compelling, great questions. We really appreciate those and taking your time out of your busy schedules to join us today. That being said, we do offer archives of our classes, so if you are unable to join any of our future offerings, make sure to visit CLUIN. You can visit and access any of our archives there. Also, you can visit our website to fill out our feedback form. That's your opportunity to receive a certificate of completion to let folks know that you participated in this course today. With that said, on behalf of ITRC, and everyone on the training today, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate all of your questions and your energy this afternoon.